Harry's amazing. So everybody you've seen sort of sits someplace else at the public health school or down at the Department of Health, but Harry actually sits with us at Brigham and is part of the team where we've been trying to do some of the evaluations and help coordinate the project. Harry actually has a background in working in primary care. He's the network manager for the Primary Care Practice-Based Research Network, so we only have half of his time in this project. He's also a pre-doctoral research fellow at Harvard Medical School, and he worked for PEPFAR for 5 years for the program at Harvard, where he was involved in overseeing the work in Nigeria and as a quality assurance manager. So he's really quite talented. And this is actually one piece that he's overseen. He's managed this, a series of research assistants going out and doing these chart reviews. So he's going to tell you about that.
We've only given him 10 minutes. So.
Yeah, we're a little short on time here today. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for attending our session today. I want to start by sharing that this is my very first APHA session, so thank you for being here. I'm a new member, so please be gentle. As you may have gathered from previous presentations this afternoon, PROMISES employs a host of techniques and tools to evaluate its intervention. Today I'll be presenting on the chart review component of our evaluation work. My presentation today is entitled Failures in High-Risk Outpatient Tests and Referral Management and Documentation. Okay, no relationships to disclose. Just walk you through an overview very quickly. To give you a sense of what I'll be talking about today, I'll start by discussing the aims of our chart review, move on to our methods for identifying and reviewing abnormal test results in high-risk referrals, then report on preliminary findings from our pre-intervention chart review. We were just starting our post-intervention chart review. We started last week. Next, present a few limitations inherent in our study and the overall outpatient landscape. And finally, I'll conclude with several thoughts on our findings and present a few conclusions. Okay. So as you can see, PROMISES employs a host of techniques and tools, as I said, to evaluate its intervention. As you heard from Sarah Singer, we collected a lot of rich and informative data by surveying practice administrators, staff, and patients. You may have ascertained as well from Judy Ling and Nicholas Leiden's presentation that we also collected data as part of our improvement work and testing cycles. And now I'll focus on our chart review, which was intended to objectively measure the impact of our intervention, complementing the more subjective patient and staff surveys. We also used pre-intervention chart review data to aid practices and improvement advisors in identifying previously unrecognized opportunities for improvement, and piloted a standardized yet hopefully flexible approach practices might adapt to conduct their own self-assessments. This also permitted more standardized comparisons of variation among the practices as we collected data as part of chart review. Okay. So as part of the baseline evaluation component, chart review was conducted at all 16 intervention sites. As a reminder, we also had 9 control sites. Documentation was assessed in 3 key areas known to pose risks for malpractice suits in primary care: management of high-risk medications, critical abnormal test results, and high-risk referrals. First, what we did is we asked our 16 demonstration practices or their lab vendors to identify up to 100 charts with abnormal test results during a 6-period window preceding the intervention, with a 2-month window in between to allow providers adequate time to follow up on results. So I'm going to step back for a second. So did everyone catch that? So flag abnormal test results for a 6-month window, wait 2 months to let the results come back in, and then start the intervention. So we focused on 5 types of tests: prostate-specific antigen greater than 5.0, thyroid-stimulating hormone greater than 10, international normalization ratio greater than 4.0, creatinine greater than 1.8, and potassium greater than 5.4. Initially, we had hoped to flag 20 charts for each type of lab test, but there were practices for which fewer than 20 abnormal labs were present for a given test, and in those cases, we randomly selected flag labs from the other 4 test types. You'll note that we elected not to perform a simple random sample of the charts, and instead we focused on an enriched sample of charts based on triggered abnormal lab tests. And this is very similar in methodology to the approach used by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement with its outpatient adverse event trigger tool. We also looked at other critical tests, guaiac positive stool, abnormal mammogram, abnormal pap smear, pulmonary nodule, abdominal mass, and abnormal colonoscopy, and we as well looked at suspicious results for breast, prostate, colon, ovarian, and skin cancer. While we ideally would have identified charts by all of these high-risk categories, unfortunately, only the test values were conducive to a database search. Okay. So once charts were identified, we used a data abstraction tool based in part on outpatient practice evaluation audit tools developed by the malpractice insurers with which we collaborate, Crico and Covaris, and a team of three research assistants and a supervising research nurse, Kathy Foskett, who unfortunately couldn't make it here today, collected information about turnaround times, documentation and completion of plans, and patient notification. So specifically for abnormal test results, we collected information on the test value and date in the chart and established whether or not the abnormal test result was found in the chart, the abnormality was noted by the responsible provider, there was a documented action or referral plan, there was documentation of patient notification, and whether or not there was evidence that treatment was completed. For high-risk referrals, we noted the referral specialty and date, the reason for the referral, and establish whether or not the return consultation was in the chart. There was evidence that the referring clinician acknowledged the consult recommendations, and whether or not there was evidence of action on specialist recommendations. Any potential adverse findings were further assessed by a general internist, Gordy Schiff, and fed back to the practices, so they might address it appropriately. And in order to ensure consistency and evaluate inter-rater reliability, two charts were reviewed by multiple members of the chart review team for each of the five lab test categories. And all this data was collected in an Access database. Okay. So the results, what do we find? Among the 16 demonstration practices, we identified 815 charts. That's about 51 charts per site, ranging from 17 to 100. And within those 815 charts, we identified a total of 1,629 abnormal test results and 73 high-risk referrals. Documentation failures were common for both tests and referrals. In some patients, actions to resolve a problem were undertaken despite the lack of documentation or acknowledgement of consultant recommendations. So, as I mentioned, we identified a total of 1,629 abnormal test results, and this is their distribution. The most commonly encountered abnormal test results were creatinine, with 551 tests reviewed, representing about 34% of all tests. Next came potassium, then TSH, INR, and PSA. The lower prevalence here of pathology and radiology tests is likely due to the fact that we had to manually screen for them in previously identified charts, as in we couldn't query a database. Okay. And, 29% of the abnormal test results, 475 of them, we identified containing at least one critical documentation failure. Okay. We identified a total of 73 high-risk referrals, 21 dermatology high-risk referrals, 17 cardiology, and so on. Admittedly, this is a low number of high-risk referrals found. We were likely limited by the number of charts reviewed and a low incidence of the targeted referral conditions and situations. So many potential high-risk referrals are not included in this graph or in our data because patients who were already being followed by or had a previous visit with a targeted specialist were not included in this. So for example, a patient with an elevated PSA who was already being followed by urology would not be included here. Okay. Of these abnormal tests, about 7%, 109 of them, were not acknowledged by the responsible provider. 18% of them, around 297. The patient, there's no documentation of patient notification of the results. No action or treatment plan was documented in 18% of charts, and no indication of follow-up treatment completion could be found, even if there was a plan documentation. So let's step back from that for a moment. Nearly 20% of patients were not notified about their results. Nearly 20% of patients did not document, of charts, did not document an action plan. And if an action plan was documented for roughly 16% of them, there was no indication that follow-up or treatment was completed. Now, the patient may have been notified and the action plan may have been completed, but from a malpractice and risk management perspective, you'll often hear the constant refrain, if it wasn't documented, it didn't happen. Okay. Forgive me, I'm flying through these. I have 10 minutes. So high-risk referral documentation failures. 38 or 52% of high-risk referrals identified contained at least one critical documentation failure, so half. Documentation failure was even more common among high-risk referrals. A returned consultation note did not appear in the chart in 22% of cases. The PCP failed to note specialist recommendations in 43% of them, and no action was taken on specialist recommendations in 44% of them. So documentation failures were common for both tests and referrals, keeping in mind, though, that in some cases, actions to resolve a problem were undertaken despite no documentation. I would also reiterate that results and documentation patterns vary greatly between practices and were highly dependent on EMR utilization. There was a question earlier about the use of electronic health record versus paper-based survey, paper-based records. We had one practice that was a full paper-based medical record, and we had another practice where providers, there was differential utilization within a practice, and a provider could elect to use the electronic health record or simply use the paper-based method. So even variation there. So a total of 126 potential adverse events were found, with 27 deemed sufficiently serious enough to warrant provider notification. And we identified a few themes upon reviewing the charts. So there was incomplete follow-through on abnormal diagnostic tests. For example, an abnormal chest x-ray was followed up. A chest CT was recommended and done. A liver nodule was found. The liver MRI was done. A biopsy recommended. And then nothing. And this last step of not being followed through, this was a very common problem. Also, non-PCP coverage can also affect test follow-up. Communication and test follow-up can be problematic when non-PCPs are covering for other providers in the practice. So, for example, a patient is visiting the PCP. He sends her out to get her TSH measured. It comes back very, very high. The patient comes in, sees the non-PCP, sees a covering provider. The covering provider speaks to the patient. It turns out that she ran out of meds, but she now has a refill. And 1 month later, the PCP, noting this high TSH, increases the dose without any retesting or confirming the patient narrative and overcorrects. Most findings involved abnormal labs rather than high-risk referrals. That makes sense based on how we identified our charts. A few potentially serious events occurred outside of the practice, for example, in the ED, only one. And few high-risk referrals, mostly specialist visits, were for pre-existing conditions. We also fed back chart review results to the practices, in addition to the survey results. Results had a very powerful impact on providers. That practice that mentioned earlier that had 40 to 50,000 open loops, he closed his entire practice for 1 week as a result of both the improvement work and receiving the chart results feedback. And it also helps spur other types or frame improvement. And this is an example of the type of data visualization they received. A few limitations. So this is a non-random enriched sample, as we discussed earlier. there were varying procedures involved for identifying abnormal lab test results. Some practices were unable to query their own systems, so they had to go to their lab vendors. There was differential lab vendor utilization. Some practices had one vendor. Other practices had multiple ones. Some at, say, Quest Diagnostics, others at the local hospital. The ability of patients in our intervention practices to opt out of chart review. Not every single physician was included. There was a variable number of charts identified per practice and physician. We had multiple reviewers. And there is a certain degree of subjectivity inherent in this type of review. Okay. So lastly, there, what we noticed were that there were significant gaps identified in management of test results, referrals, and communication in diverse ambulatory practices. Many results went unacknowledged, and referrals to specialists were often not followed up. Many practices were unable to easily query their own records to identify high-risk tests, and they had to request patient data from their lab vendors. Incomplete follow-through, confusion over tests ordered by cross-covering MDs, and failure to document actions actually taken emerges some of the leading issues. To conclude, there were serious gaps in acknowledgement, follow-up, and documentation of multiple abnormal lab test and high-risk referrals, many of which had the potential to harm patients. There were striking findings, including no documentation of providers notifying patients about 20% of abnormal lab test results, and a significant number of tests that were entirely unacknowledged. Referral management also represents an important area of focus for quality improvement to reduce malpractice risk, and successfully completing and documenting steps required to manage tests and their results, as well as referrals and recommendations, is complex, it's risk-prone, and the rates are unacceptable. That's it. Thank you. Sorry for that.
We're a couple minutes over, but let's take one question for Harry, if there is one, although I think we've covered some of the landscape even of his questions. Any single last question? Ollie.
Right, so for creatinine was a special case, in fact, because we had such high numbers for them, the highest, as you saw, that after three, after documenting three for a given chart, we stopped counting. And what we did is if there was a pattern and the physician had noted that pattern, then we stopped counting them. So they were actually the highest, I would say.
But we were looking for new abnormals.
New abnormals.
So we were careful to try to not, somebody has chronic renal failure, we didn't repeatedly ding them. But we can look at that specific question. Bobby, yeah, we'll make this the last question.
On the radiology follow-up, radiologists always ask the follow-up, so what does that mean?
Sorry.
Because
they're hedging, yeah. Could be this, maybe that, sort of, is that what you're getting at?
Exactly, yeah, good.
Well, I think it's still up to the physician to document. They've acknowledged it, and that if no action plan is needed, then they need to put that in the chart.
Yeah, the radiologists are creating risk, and you know, we've talked to radiologists a lot in the course of this project and thinking about this, so it's another one of those things that we're really shining a spotlight on and hardly solving with a single intervention here. I see one last hand, or it looks like Lisa, you want to? No. So thank you everybody. It's really.